From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the songwriting team behind the hit Broadway musical Avenue Q, Robert Lopez and Jeff Marx. The show imagines what it would be like if the young adults who grew up on Sesame Street had puppets singing songs about the latest crises in their lives, like finding a job, paying the rent, and coming out. It won 3 Tony Awards this year, including Best Musical. Also, we talk with artist Red Grooms about Ruckus Manhattan and his other paintings and sculptures of New York. A new book collects reproductions of 50 years of his work. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Hatchet Jobs, the collection of criticism by Dale Peck, the controversial book reviewer for The New Republic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer. President Bush is calling for the establishment of a National Director of Intelligence with oversight of all U.S. intelligence operations. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The creation of a so-called intelligence czar position was one of the most prominent recommendations included in the report by the Commission on the 9/11 attacks. The president has asked Congress to act quickly on the proposal when the summer recess ends after Labor Day, but he differs with the Commission, which said a national intelligence director should operate within the executive branch. The president said the director should be appointed by the president, but not part of the cabinet.
I will hire a person. And I can fire the person, which is any president would like. That's how you have accountability in government.
Mr. Bush said he will have more announcements about intelligence reforms in the days ahead. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry said today that Bush administration policies are helping terrorists recruit new members because the White House has alienated other countries. Kerry says terrorists are using anger against the U.S. as a recruitment tool. President Bush dismissed Kerry's charges as ridiculous. The president says terrorists aren't plotting against the U.S. because his administration is on the offensive. Police armed with assault rifles protected U.S. financial centers in New York, Washington, and Newark, New Jersey today after warnings yesterday that terrorists were plotting attacks. Some streets around the New York Stock Exchange were closed off. Workers at the IMF and World Bank in Washington underwent extra security checks, but some of them, such as Teresa Marchier, were skeptical.
What can they do, really, to protect us? If they really think something is going to happen, then just close the building, because I don't think anything else would be that effective.
Extra precautions were taken in Newark today because the Prudential Building in downtown Newark was included in the terror alert. Chris Keating of member station WBGO reports.
Set in the heart of Newark, the 24-story Prudential Building is surrounded with concrete barricades and guarded by police wearing battle armor and carrying M16s. Still a rather calm, Mayor Sharp James says workers here and throughout the city should feel safe in spite of the terror threats.
We've created a plan for air, ground, and interior security, and they should feel comfortable coming to work and going out, and traffic is flowing.
Prudential employees who arrived for work confessed to being nervous about going in the building. Others say they promised to call their husbands and wives every hour to tell them they were okay. For NPR News, I'm Chris Keating in Newark.
On Wall Street, the Dow gained 39 points today to close at 10,179 in active trading. The Nasdaq was up 4 points at 1892. The S&P gained 5 at 1106. This is NPR. Tropical storm Alex is predicted to become a hurricane sometime tomorrow as it moves up the North Carolina coast. From member station WUNC in Raleigh, Laura Leslie reports.
National Weather Service forecasters say Alex is expected to strengthen overnight. They've upgraded storm warnings to hurricane warnings from Cape Lookout north through the Outer Banks and Pamlico Sound. Alex is now about 150 miles southwest of Wilmington, moving toward the coast at 6 miles per hour. The storm should turn to the northeast later tonight, staying just offshore, but the center is expected to come very near the Outer Banks tomorrow, with heavy rains, high surf, and sustained winds over 60 miles an hour. For NPR News, I'm Laura Leslie in Raleigh.
Federal officials have rejected two companies' requests to resume using several large air tankers to fight wildfires. The officials say more information is needed on the life of the planes. The U.S. Forest Service and Interior Department announced last spring they were ending the contracts for 33 air tankers because of concerns about whether they were airworthy. Survivors of a deadly supermarket fire yesterday in Paraguay say locked doors prevented or slowed shoppers' escapes. Investigators are examining the remains of the store, looking for evidence that would help determine whether guards locked the doors to keep shoppers from fleeing the fire without paying. The store's two owners say the doors were not locked. They've been detained for questioning. The fire killed more than 300 people and injured hundreds more. It was Paraguay's worst disaster in decades. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer, NPR News, in Washington.
The NPR Shop offers Driveway Moments, a 2-CD collection of public radio stories so compelling they won't let you go, at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Broadway musical Avenue Q won 3 Tony Awards this year, Best Musical, Best Original Score, and Best Book of a Musical. My guests Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks wrote the songs and came up with the show's original concept. Their idea was to write a musical that took the kind of songs and puppets that they grew up with watching Sesame Street and imagine what it would be like if those puppets sang songs that gave advice to young mixed-up adults about being single, finding a job, coming out, and so on. New York Times theater critic Ben Brantley wrote, "The songwriting of Lopez and Marks demonstrates that ambivalence, indecision, and low expectations can be the basis for a thoroughly infectious musical." The cast of the show includes actors and puppets. Here's a song about political correctness. It's called "Everyone's a Little Bit Racist," and it's sung by a group of white, African-American, and Asian actors, along with several puppets.
Say, Kate, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Well, you know Trekkie Monster upstairs?
Uh-huh.
Well, he's Trekkie Monster and you're Kate Monster.
Right.
You're both monsters.
Yeah.
Are you two related?
What? Princeton, I'm surprised at you. I find that racist.
Well, I'm sorry, I was just asking.
Well, it's a touchy subject. No, not all monsters are related. What are you trying to say, huh? That we all look the same to you?
No, No! Oh, not at all. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess that was a little racist.
I should say so. You should be much more careful when you're talking about the sensitive subject of race.
Well, look who's talking.
What do you mean?
What about that special monster school you told me about?
What about it?
Well, could someone like me go there?
No, we don't want people like you.
You see? You're a little bit racist.
Well, you're a little bit too.
I guess we're both a little bit racist.
Admitting it is not an easy thing to do.
But I guess it's true.
Between me and you, I think everyone's a little bit racist.
Sometimes. Doesn't mean we go around committing hate crimes. Look around and you will find no one's really colorblind. Maybe it's a fact we all should face. Everyone makes judgments based on race. Now, not big judgments like who.
I asked songwriters Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks if there were landmines they had to be careful of in writing that song.
We usually write in public. We write on the streets of New York City and in cafes, and we have a very collaborative process where each of us is writing lyrics and throwing lines and bouncing ideas off one another. And we were on a bus, I remember, writing this song. And all of a sudden, I realized that everyone was sort of looking at us. And,
we were singing that Christmas Eve part about the Jews have our money and the whites have... Yeah. I mean, it's okay for an Asian woman to be singing it because, she, has permission to do that. But we don't really.
And we whenever we write the songs, we would speak in the character voices. So we would sort
Monsters
of do a mock Japanese accent for Christmas Eve. We'd do a Gary Coleman accent, whatever
that was. It was really offensive.
It was pretty offensive. So we had our share of horrified onlookers.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the very premise of Avenue Q?
I guess to just put it all in a nutshell, Avenue Q is a fictional place. It's a community way outside. It's in New York City, but it's way out in the boroughs, far away from Midtown Manhattan. It's the only place where college graduates can afford to live with their BAs in English and their entry-level jobs and their crappy lives. And it's a place where some of these inhabitants are puppets. And they all get along together in this building on Avenue Q. So
very much like an adult version of a children's show you may remember, except these are all college graduates, and a lot of them are unemployed and looking for their purpose in life and trying to make
find
ends
their way
meet
in the world. Yeah.
And dealing with breakups and relationships.
So how do you use the puppets interacting with the actors on stage?
Well, the puppeteers are they walk around on stage in full view. They're dressed in black and gray, and they hold the puppets in front of them, and they walk around carrying them. And the puppets have no they're cut off at the waist. They have no lower nothing below, no legs, and they talk. The puppets talk to each other. The puppeteers really don't acknowledge each other.
No.
They do their acting through the puppets, and there's some human characters too. There's Brian, there's Christmas Eve, and there's Gary Coleman. And those human characters interact with the puppets. Nobody interacts with the puppeteers. They're just there to, breathe life into the puppets.
Yeah, the puppets are the characters, and the style of puppetry and the style of puppets is very much in the children's television Jim Henson kind of vein. And what we're able to see on the stage of Avenue Q is the style of puppetry. You're able to see the puppeteers do their work.
Now, with Sesame Street, the equivalent of Broadway musicals for you when you were growing up was Jeff Moss, who wrote a lot of the songs. Your Cole Porter was Miss Piggy, your Ethel Merman.
Yes.
In a way, yes. Yeah. Well, we definitely looked at the songs of Jeff Moss and Joe Raposo and held them up as models. Paul Williams. They did amazing work back then, and we were all watching it and taking it in. And I think it probably was our first exposure as kids to characters breaking into song, which is part of the reason why we chose to work with puppets in the first place in our adult lives. We wanted to, we realized that musical theater has become something of a cliche to our generation. Not that we agree with that.
And let's face it, I mean, you don't really see people our age too much listening to Oklahoma and Funny Girl.
Right. But
it's just, it's a bygone era for the most part.
We realized that when a puppet breaks into song, there's not a bone in your body that says, oh, right, that puppet would never break into song. Because you're already trusting that it's alive. You already believe that it's alive.
But did you initially intend to write these songs for a kids' musical? I mean, this is an adult musical. But when you started writing songs with the idea that puppets would be singing them, were you thinking it was going to be for kids?
Never.
No. We wanted to write a musical about ourselves and our friends and the idea that people our age were coming out of college. I was coming out of grad school. We were both living in apartments owned by, I was living in an apartment owned by my parents. Bobby was living with his parents. So was everybody else we knew. And the people who were out living on their own, were out in Queens and Brooklyn where you wouldn't really even want to visit. After college, when you are, even through college, you're led to believe that you can go out and set the world on fire. But you find out quickly that
it's a lot more complicated than that.
Well, this reminds me of a song. Let's hear another song from the cast recording of Avenue Q. And this is a song you both wrote called It Sucks to Be Me, in which everybody is thinking that their life is even worse than the next person's life. And they're almost competing for whose life is more depressing.
That's the opening number. Right after Princeton sings What Do You Do with a B.A. in English, everybody comes out and sings this.
So this is It Sucks to Be Me from the cast recording of Avenue Q.
When I was little, I thought I would be
what?
A big comedian on late night TV.
Oh.
But now I'm 32, and as you can see, I'm not.
Nope.
Oh, well. It sucks to be me.
No.
It sucks to be me.
No.
It sucks to be broke and unemployed and turning 33. It sucks to be me.
You think your life sucks?
I think so.
Your problems aren't so bad. I'm kind of pretty. I'm pretty damn smart.
You are.
Thanks.
I have a job.
Can I have a date?
It sucks to be me.
You're not my mother, Rod.
Hey, Rod, Nikki, can you settle something for us? Do you have a second?
Certainly.
Whose life sucks more, Brian's or mine?
Ours.
We live together.
We're close as people can get.
That's music from a cast recording of Avenue Q. My guests Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks wrote the songs for the show. Well, let me ask you, what was the most depressing aspects of your lives when you got out of college and were trying to make that transition into figuring out what you were going to do next, figuring out what your adult lives were going to be like? Bobby, let's start with you.
Well, when I was in college, I knew I wanted to write for the musical theater, and I don't think I knew exactly how stupid a dream that was because so few people get to do it and have a living at it. But I didn't give myself a plan B. I didn't give myself another career path that I might have in mind. I just decided I would move to New York and do it, and I ended up moving back in with my parents. So I was living in New York, and I realized, well, nothing is going to be happening for me. I'm not going to have a Broadway musical for a while now. And I was temping, and I was living with my parents, and that's being on the bottom of a very, very tall totem pole. You realize that, you know, suddenly you're in the middle of this hierarchy. College is a very equal, you know, egalitarian society where everyone goes to the school. Doesn't matter how much money you make, doesn't matter, you know, who you are. Everyone's a student. But when you get out of college, you realize, oh, it's all about money. It's all about success and who you are. You know, if you live with your parents and you want to be a Broadway composer, tough luck. So that was that. I realized, oh well, I've got a very long, difficult journey ahead of me. And it's sort of funny when you take a long view of it. And I think a lot of that humor was part of the humor we were able to find in Avenue Q.
I think this is Jeff. When you come out of school, and in fact, the better the school, Bobby went to Yale, the better the school, the worse you feel it. You feel like you just have this vague notion that you're talented and you're smart and you're going to do something with your life that's important or respectable. And when you get out of college, there just are not all these opportunities banging down your door, like I suppose when you're a college kid, you dream that there will be. And the truth is, that with time, what you're thrust out into the world and you figure out how to make your own life. But, those first few weeks, months, and years out of college, college does not prepare you for real life, so you don't know what the hell to do with yourself.
I remember I was temping. I temped for Pfizer Pharmaceuticals, and my job was to sit and write these form letters every day, all day long, to satisfied Viagra customers who would write in with their ideas. They people would be so happy with Viagra that they would come up with a jingle and they'd send it into Pfizer. And I had to tell them, Bob Dole is our spokesperson currently, and we have a advertising campaign, and that was my life.
But
wait! Do you remember any of the jingles?
Oh, I should have saved them, but I wasn't allowed to. I wish.
Wow.
Oh well.
For copyright reasons, we're not allowed to.
My guests are songwriters Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks. We'll talk more about their musical Avenue Q after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks wrote the songs for the hit musical Avenue Q. Now, you met each other at a BMI workshop. Do I have that right?
Yeah, it's called the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop. It's a great program for aspiring musical theater writers. We'd only been working together for about a year, and we had written a project. Although, you know, I had been writing songs my whole life since I was 11 years old. I've been wanting to write for the musical theater.
I didn't. I was brand new at it. I didn't really write until I met Bobby in the workshop.
But we, our very first project together was something called Kermit, Prince of Denmark. Assignment was to write an adaptation, a full musical, and in this version of Hamlet, of course, everyone lives at the end, and it's a funny case of mistaken identity. Kermit the Frog is on his way in the beginning is in an airport on his way to meet his buddies, the other Muppets, in Denver, Colorado, and he gets on the wrong plane and ends up in Denmark. Get it?
Got it.
So we wrote a whole bunch of songs for that, just one after the other. They came real easy. The class was laughing their butts off. We were having a great time. We won a huge award for it, a huge cash award for it, which helped us not have to temp so much and actually write more. So we went, hey, maybe there's something to this. We started getting jobs writing stuff for the Disney Channel for a touring children's theater company called TheaterWorks USA. When those jobs really were supporting us, we said, all right, let's write something for real, for adults, for people like us. And the idea came to us for Avenue Q.
So is there a verse that you can sing from Kermit, Prince of Frog of Denmark, or Prince of Denmark, which was it called?
Kermit, Prince of Denmark.
Kermit, Prince of Denmark. We could sing it, or we could even get you the demo if you want.
Sing it.
I've packed my sweaters, my shoes, and my slacks. Turned off the email, the phone, and the fax. I'm on vacation. It's time to relax in Denver. La, la, la. Doo. I'm going skiing and taking it slow. I find it freeing to go with the flow. With all my being, I'm ready to go to Denver.
And he gets on the wrong plane going to Denmark. Mayhem ensues,
every
great Muppet movie should.
Now, Jeff, you mentioned that you had never written songs until you met Bobby at this workshop. So,
right.
No, my understanding is that you both write the music and the lyrics together. Jeff, did you have a music background?
Yeah, I had always played piano by ear. I still don't read music,
mm-hmm.
Which is why Bobby usually plays the piano. But I played for myself, and I read the chords, and I played at cocktail bars and stuff like that. But I had never written anything, and I had always sung, and I was a musical theater performance major in college. But I found that I didn't enjoy acting. And I didn't feel that I wanted to go make a career out of it, so I went into law school. And I went through law school, and in law school, they have a parody review every year called the Law Review.
A UE review.
Exactly, the UE review. And I ended up writing some songs for that. It was my first time writing anything, and I found that I was actually good at it. And I took some of the lyrics, and I applied to the BMI workshop, hoping that I could get into this community where I would meet young, talented people and find clients. And instead of finding clients, I found a collaborator and stopped practicing law, and Bob and I have been making a living writing musicals.
Well, I want to play another song from your musical, Avenue Q. And this again, is an adult take on the kind of song you used to hear on Sesame Street. It's called If You Were Gay. Would you set it up for us? Tell us what's happening in the story when this song is sung.
Well, this is our introduction to two of the major characters, but not the main characters. They're two roommates, Nikki and Rod. Nikki is a lovable freeloader. He's sort of rotund and cute and pudgy.
Jolly.
Jolly. And Rod is an uptight investment banker who you'll find in the song is in the closet.
He's also a Republican.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so let's hear it. This is If You Were Gay from the cast recording of Avenue Q.
Why do I care about some gay guy you met, okay? I am trying to be.
Well, I didn't mean anything by it, Rod. I just think it's something we should be able to talk about.
Well, I do not want to talk about it, Nikki. This conversation is over.
Yeah, but Rod...
Over!
Well, okay, but just so you know, if you were gay, that'd be okay. I mean, 'cause hey, I'd like you anyway. Because you see, If it were me, I would feel free to say that I was gay, but I'm not gay.
Nikki, please, I am trying to read. What?
If you were queer,
Nikki,
I'd still be here.
Nikki, I am trying to read this book.
Year after year.
Nikki.
Because you're dear to me. And I know that you would accept me too.
I would?
If I told you today.
Hey, guess what? I'm gay.
But I'm not gay. I'm happy just being with you.
I'm in shoes, pal Joey.
So what should it matter to me what you do in bed with guys?
Hey, that is wrong.
No, it's not. If you were gay. On me to always be beside you every day to tell you it's okay. You were just born that way, and as they say, it's in your DNA. You're gay.
I am not gay.
If you were gay.
That's from the cast recording of Avenue Q, and my guests, Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks, wrote the songs for the show. It won 3 Tonys this year, including Best Musical. Okay, well, Jeff, I don't think I'm giving away anything here. Jeff, you're gay, and Bobby, you're straight.
That's right. So. How'd you know that?
And married.
That's true. I just got married in October.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations. So I'm wondering, what are some of the personal things from life that might have inspired the song?
This song?
Yeah.
The more personal stuff in Avenue Q is about the relationships and the breakups. There's a Fine, Fine Line was written when Bobby and I were both going through hard times in our relationships. And there's a song called The More You Love Someone, The More You Want to Kill Them, which came directly out of the same thing. I think that was really out of my boyfriend troubles.
Well, I mean, the truth is that Jeff was already out of the closet when I met him, so I never had to, nudgingly poke him out, as Nikki does in that song. But when you're straight in the musical theater business, people are always trying to tell you, "Oh, come on, you're gay. You just don't know it yet," or "You're gay. Come on, admit it." And I really, I always had to say, "No, I'm not." So I kind of identify with Rod in that song, even though he is.
I never thought of it that way.
Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks wrote the songs for the musical Avenue Q. They'll be back in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delacorte Press, publisher of Lucifer's Shadow by David Hewson, a novel of intrigue and art spanning 3 centuries in Venice, new in hardcover. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, artist Red Grooms describes his vision of Ruckus Manhattan. There's a new book collecting his work. Maureen Carrigan reviews Hatchet Jobs by Dale Peck, the controversial book reviewer for The New Republic. And Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks talk about Muppet songs, TV themes, and other music that influenced their musical Avenue Q.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jeff Marks and Robert Lopez. They wrote the songs for the Broadway musical Avenue Q and came up with the concept for the show. It won 3 Tonys this year, including Best Musical and Best Original Score. It's an adult show inspired by the puppets and songs Marks and Lopez grew up with, watching children's shows like Sesame Street. What are your favorite Muppet songs from when you were kids that you grew up with?
Oh, so many.
I think you can't beat Rubber Ducky.
The Rainbow Connection is just a fantastic song.
You know, there's a song that's not really that well known. Maybe it's just not known by me when I was a kid because it was written later. But it's called I Don't Want to Live on the Moon. And it was written by Jeff Moss, and Ernie sings it.
You want to sing a few bars of it?
I would like to visit the moon on a rocket ship high in the air. Yes, I'd like to visit the moon, but I don't think I'd like to live there. Though I'd like to look down at the earth from above, I would miss all the places and people I love. So although I may go, I'll be coming home soon, because I don't want to live on the moon.
That's sweet. I'm wondering if TV themes made a big impression on you, too, when you were young?
Yeah, I remember loving the Gilligan's Island theme. I would sing it in the shower, and there's all these tapes of me when I'm 4 years old singing the Gilligan's Island theme.
Really?
Yeah.
I remember loving, the show didn't last long, but the song sure did, The Greatest American Hero.
Oh, me too.
Believe it or not, I'm walking on air. I never thought I could feel so free. Flying away on a wing and a prayer. Yeah. Who could it be? Yeah. Believe it or
Jeff
not.
Jeff and Bobby sing the
it's
hits.
It's just me. Do we need to pay royalties for that?
Oh, that's great. So did either of you ever write for a rock band or a pop band?
No.
We actually thought about it. We wanted to, at one point, do songs just for the hell of it, like a Beatles album, but we never got around to it.
Yeah, we like to write for situations, and we like to have specific characters in our songs. There's something about adding music to drama that allows you to, I don't know, I think the originality of being able to pair a song with a dramatic situation is what's attractive, at least to me, about musicals.
I agree. When one character is singing it to another character for a particular reason, to get something out of the other character or to communicate something or, you know, to get to another plot point, mm-hmm. It takes you somewhere more than when Johnny Mathis sings the song, which is also great, but it's a different purpose. You know, in the dramatic context, it's more of a participation with the audience.
I have another kids' TV question for you. If Sesame Street was like the Broadway of children's television because of all the great songs, then I think Schoolhouse Rock was like the jazz hipster place because, you know, you have like Bob Dureau and Dave Frischberg and Jack Sheldon doing the music for
and
it.
Lynn Ahrens did some of it.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
She went on to write musicals.
Yeah, she went on to write Ragtime and Once on This Island and a lot of big Broadway stuff. Anastasia, the movie.
So did you watch any Schoolhouse Rock?
Sure. I never saw that, actually.
Oh, I did. I did.
I got into it later, though.
I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Mm-hmm. I hope someday I'll be a law. Yes, I hope and I pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Did you ever see there's a Simpsons episode that parodies that
oh,
song?
Oh, yes.
Amendment to be. Yes, an amendment to be. And it's like he's a flag-burning amendment sitting on
it's
the
It's right after
of
the contract for America.
We should do one now.
Yeah, right,
constitutional
exactly.
Amendment about gays not marrying.
I grew up on children's television, definitely. But my show was Electric Company as a kid. They, you know, had Easy Reader, and it was a little bit more advanced than Sesame Street and Mister Rogers. But I was really into it, and it had some puppets on it too. The words were longer, and I remember a song called T-I-O-N. It was T-I-O-N shun 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 shun, which explained a rather complicated, you know, spelling rule. I think we're definitely children of the 70s. Jeff was born in 70. I was born in 75. And that, during that time, the kids were just exposed to so much education on television. There wasn't so much of the I don't know, stuff that's like the Teletubbies and Barney and stuff that's just aimed to keep kids quiet. This was all really, really quality stuff that was mm-hmm. on back then. And I kind of wish I was able to raise a kid in that time period instead of looking at the possibility of having to do it now.
Well, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for talking with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you a lot.
And my guests have been Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks, who wrote the songs for the musical Avenue Q.
Why does everything have to be so hard?
Maybe you'll never find your purpose.
Lots of people don't.
But then I don't even know why I'm alive.
Well, who does, really? Everyone's a little bit unsatisfied.
Everyone goes round a little empty inside.
Take a breath, look around,
swallow your pride.
For now,
nothing lasts,
life goes on,
full of surprises.
You'll be faced with problems of all shapes and sizes.
You're going to have to make a few compromises for now.
For now.
Accept the things we cannot avoid for now.
For now.
For now.
For now.
But only for now.
For now.
Only for now.
For now.
Only for now.
For now.
Only for now. Only for now.
Now there's life.
Only for now.
That's For Now from the cast recording of Avenue Q. Robert Lopez and Jeff Marks wrote the songs for the musical. Coming up, artist Red Grooms and his vision of a ruckus Manhattan. This is Fresh Air. My guest is painter and sculptor Red Grooms. A new book collects reproductions of 50 years of his work, along with critical essays about him. Grooms grew up in Tennessee, but he's best known for his paintings and sculptures of Manhattan. In the mid-70s, he created an installation piece called Ruckus Manhattan that transformed a large Manhattan gallery into a three-dimensional, miniature, comic book-like version of the city. You actually walk through a Red Grooms subway car to get into that city. Groom said, "What I wanted to do was a novelistic portrait of Manhattan from Battery Park to Grant's Tomb. I also felt it had to include the dark sides of life as well as the lighter ones, prostitutes, thieves, and gamblers, tourists, shoppers, babies, moms, and dads. I wanted to get it all in. It got quite busy." Although much of his work depicts Manhattan before September 11th, Grooms continues to paint the city, and the new book includes several of his canvases about New York after the attacks. Red Grooms, welcome to Fresh Air. The first thing I'd like to do is read an excerpt of the essay that Arthur Danto wrote in your new book. And he says, and he's referring to when you started doing your New York work, "The city was still reeling from the upheavals of the 60s, and the air was sour with kind of hopeless desperation. My sense of ruckus Manhattan was that it ridiculed the decay and made the dirt, disorder, and menace all at once funny. And yet, exactly because what it lowered through comedy was itself so powerful, so full of threat, violent energy, and even terror, it abruptly made it over into something we could live with and even come to cherish. It was an enactment so filled with affection and fun that all at once the city, Manhattan, despite its social disorder, became a place of wonder." That sounds really right to me in terms of the effect that it has on turning Manhattan, which could be a very kind of threatening, oppressive place, into a place of wonder. Does that sound right to you?
Yes, it was actually
Arthur wrote a review after we had finished it in 1976, and it was so encouraging what he said. And actually, he defined the moment, I think, as well as it could have been defined.
What were, like in the 60s and 70s, what were your favorite New York places or buildings or neon signs, delicatessens?
Oh, well, the big Bond sign on Times Square, you know, that had these, it was a big waterfall, really. I don't even know what Bond's is. I think it was a clothing store that was in the building below.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of a men's haberdashery or something. I may be wrong on that. And it had these colossal, kind of an Adam and Eve, and they were nude. And there was this, and a terrific waterfall. And then somehow in the midst of that, I think, was the great cigarette ad, I guess, for Camels, you know, that actually smoked. It would blow out smoke rings.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I thought that was just great.
Mm-hmm. How did you realize that the city could be a great subject for you?
I don't know exactly, but I always was fascinated from childhood with some kind of mythic city that I felt that Nashville wasn't really.
Mm-hmm.
It was too small. And I used to, you know, kind of daydream about it being bigger, having taller buildings and more people. And I don't know. I was a big movie fan. Maybe I got it from the movies or something. You know, big spectacle films. I like books about the Middle Ages. So, you know, the medieval towns, for instance, the wall cities. There's some kind of energy that's confined there. And I like that a lot. You know, that seemed like big time to me.
Now, you've done a few portraits of New York since September 11th. And let me ask you to describe your painting, Heroes on a Shield.
Yes, my wife and I actually are just 10 blocks north of the Trade Towers, and we saw the initial hit on the North Tower from our apartment, and it was just overwhelmingly staggering event. So afterwards, you know, during the whole process afterwards, I didn't really know what to do about it. I couldn't really respond visually, but I did think, actually I was thinking back about the superheroes like Marvel, Captain Marvel and his shield, and so I thought of the shield as being, you know, protective. And then it was, so that piece really is about the people that were had taken it on themselves to protect the city and to do the work, the very tough work that was required to get back on our feet, the police and the firefighters, the mayor. And I haven't yet done anything, and probably never will, about the actual event itself.
I'm interested in hearing what your dreams look like or what they looked like when you were younger. And part of what I'd like to know is if you ever dreamed in the kind of cartoon imagery that you came to incorporate in your paintings.
Well, I can tell you that more recently, I've had extraordinary dreams that are very, very, very sinister, like Bosch paintings, you know, of hell, just incredibly sinister things happening.
Would you describe one of the images from one of those Bosch-like dreams?
Well, there's a lot of morphing,
mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of stuff turning into other stuff, and it's like entirely evil and just amazing, you know, and completely surreal. And I have quite a few of those. I don't really know the reason for it.
Were there paintings or images that scared you when you were very young?
Yes, I was very frightened by the Parthenon in Nashville. Nashville has this famous replica of the Athens Parthenon, and it has a marvelous sculpture of Athena, but at the time, it was totally empty except for these strange Greek sculptures along the wall. And when my parents would take me in there, I just wouldn't go in. I was screamed and ran out because of this big, vast space. I didn't like it at all.
You've suggested that, in your new book, you suggest that it might be that fear of big, empty space that explains all the kind of, you know, cluttered, crowded, jangled imagery in your paintings.
Yes, with the horror vacui.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know exactly why I have that either. I am claustrophobic, I must say, but I don't know why I have that. The busy thing is sometimes it's just because I can't edit or something. So I'm trying to get everything in. And therefore, I have to use up all the space right up to every last, you know, little bit of it.
Now, you live part of the year in Manhattan and part of
yes.
the year in Tennessee. And I think
Correct.
It's rural Tennessee, about 3 hours out of Nashville. And some of your Tennessee paintings are included in the new book. And the style of painting is similar but very different. You know, most, I'd say, of the Tennessee paintings are much kind of calmer, both in the style and in the subject matter. I mean, you have paintings of logs and grass. And
right. That's because, you know what?
Yeah.
I thought I could be a kind of Andy Wythe in Tennessee, like Brandywine, you know?
Yeah.
Then I realized, my gosh, nobody likes Wythe anyway. And, you know, I wasn't really up to his stuff. I can't do that like he can do it, you know? And so, yeah, at first I was really kind of proceeding along those lines, but because I do shows in New York, and there's a time limit, and I really have to work on the New York stuff. I work on my New York stuff a lot down in Tennessee.
You do have a Tennessee piece that kind of fits with the New York sensibility that you're famous for, and I'm thinking of the Tennessee Foxtrot Carousel, which is a carousel where instead of horses, you ride on historical figures, ranging from like the Everly Brothers to Andrew Jackson and Davy Crockett. And were you specifically commissioned to do a carousel?
No, it was my concept to do it. Actually, I wanted to make a small sort of a sculpture amusement park. I've always wanted to do that, actually. And I'd had a large show at Grand Central Terminal. This was in 93, and I was kind of excited by the response to that. So I really thought I could start. Actually, my intention was it would be a commercial park.
Oh, like a real commercial.
Yeah, like,
right.
Like a, yeah, because, you know, I always like, you know, P.T. Barnum is one of my heroes.
So, so when people pay to get on the carousel, who gets the money?
Well, actually, unfortunately, nobody is right now because they had to disassemble the carousel after this would be its fifth year because it sort of went into debt and needed help. It's run by a nonprofit group. And now there will be a delay right now because it's going to eventually go to the Tennessee State Museum, and they're going to have a special pavilion for it.
Oh well, too bad. But at least
well, it'll
be in the
museum,
bounce back. So that's great. Yeah,
and then
yeah.
Hopefully they'll charge.
But they'll keep the
Hope
money.
Hope somebody
right?
makes some money. Yeah.
Well, Red Grooms, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Artist Red Grooms, the new book Red Grooms, is a retrospective of his work along with three critical essays. Coming up, our book critic Maureen Carrigan reviews a new collection by Dale Peck, a critic famous in the book world for his negative reviews. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
A new collection of book reviews called Hatchet Jobs by critic Dale Peck has some of his colleagues talking about the death of civility in reviewing, while others are hailing Peck as the courageous voice of reason and truth. Book critic Maureen Corrigan throws in her two cents.
This year's Fiddling While Rome Burns Award for Most Entertaining but Insular Literary Controversy goes to the brouhaha over Dale Peck and his notoriously nasty book reviews. Given that you're listening to this book review, you may be one of the 20 or so Americans who know who Dale Peck is. I arrive at that guesstimate based on the recent NEA report that told us what we already know. The number of Americans who read literary fiction, plays, and poetry is drastically shrinking. For the unenlightened masses who don't know Dale Peck from Dale Earnhardt, he's a book reviewer who writes for the New Republic and other venues, and he's made a name for himself by, among other things, suggesting, in perhaps the greatest non sequitur in the history of the printed word, that the writing of novelist David Foster Wallace might be improved by having, how shall I put this, vigorous anal relations with another man. Peck is also known for making impossible-to-prove pronouncements in his reviews, the most famous being the opening line of his review of a memoir by Rick Moody. Rick Moody is the worst writer of his generation. You can read these shockers and more in the just-published collection of reprinted review essays by Peck called Hatchet Jobs. Since it's my turn to weigh in on Peck and his works, I'll officially declare myself on the fence. A position, by the way, that Peck, who embraces extremes, would surely disdain. Many of Peck's witchy observations throughout Hatchet Jobs made me laugh out loud, like I do when I read consistently more acute critics like James Wolcott and Christopher Hitchens. Peck undeniably has a voice, opinions, and a lot of energy. In a genre that's clogged with quote-larded book reports masking his book reviews, his caustic essays evince a Drano-like ability to cut through the sludge. Commenting, for instance, on the market-driven trend toward identity politics in literature that categorizes otherwise unrelated books under the labels black literature or gay literature, Peck says that such divisions have about as much validity as the chalk line Lucy used to draw down the center of the apartment she shared with Ricky, splitting couch, table, and coffee pot in half. But here's a problem. Peck often trains his big critical guns on puny targets. That quote I just read about the inanity of grouping books by the race or sexual orientation of their authors appears in a scathing roundup review of new novels by Terry McMillan, Sapphire, and Jamaica Kincaid. A negative review of those writers, with the possible exception of Kincaid, is what's known in the trade as a dog bites man story. When Peck does go after the big game, his firepower isn't nearly as dazzling as he tells us it is. Peck's big theory about the state of contemporary literature is that it all went wrong with James Joyce. From Joyce through Pynchon and DeLillo, he says, literature split into self-referential experimentation or dumbed-down realism. When Peck elaborates on his pet theory in the afterword to this collection, he tells us how daring he's being. Though I normally write in the morning, I am writing this in the middle of the night like a fugitive. My hands are literally shaking as I type. Sometimes even I am overwhelmed by the extent of the reevaluation I'm calling for, the sheer, expletive deleted, presumptuousness of it. But this kind of chest thumping about the canon has been going on throughout the 20th century. In the 1930s and 40s, the renowned British critic F.R. Leavis dissed Jane Austen, Dickens, and virtually the entire comic tradition in English. And in the 1960s, American critic Dwight MacDonald identified this same split between high art and mass cult. The firing squad didn't come for Leavis or MacDonald at dawn to execute them for their radical views, and Peck needn't shake so much for simply joining their ranks. And for someone so allegedly radical, Peck is quite conservative in terms of the types of books he even chooses to notice. There's nary a kind word here about genre fiction or memoir or the embattled numbers of mid-list writers whose work has profoundly shaped the interior lives of the readers who love them. Lori Colwyn, Lori Moore, Scott Spencer, Christopher Tillman, these and other superb writers don't fall into Peck's polarized high art, low art categories. Here's a utopian thought. Maybe if Peck and the rest of the reviewing community, myself included, devoted more space to the wonderful writers out there who haven't gotten their due, rather than to the established big names or easy targets, the NEA might have less occasion to issue another gloom and doom report about the nation's lack of enthusiasm for reading.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Hatchet Jobs by Dale Peck. I'm Terry Gross.
Is your figure less than Greek?
We learned today that the recording engineer David Baker died in his sleep last month of an apparent heart attack. He was 58. During his 40-year career, he recorded a wide range of musicians, including Shirley Horn, Art Farmer, George Russell, Maceo Parker, John Zorn, and Sun Ra. In fact, he was one of the recording and mixing engineers for the first Fresh Air theme, which was composed and performed by pianist Jackie Byard. In 1998, David Baker won a Grammy for his work on this Shirley Horn CD, I Remember Miles, which he recorded and mixed.
You're my funny Valentine. Sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile with your heart.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org. And from Nonsuch Records, featuring Hymns of the 49th Parallel, the new album by Katie Lang, a tribute to Canadian songwriters Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, and five others. It's available at Barnes & Noble Music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, satirists Bill Maher and Colin Quinn talk about the presidential campaign, the conventions, and the new terrorism alert. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.